radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome to Training and Tactics Talk. I'm Douglas Klein, your host, and today we've got a powerful show talking about tactics and ways of training that are going to be appropriate to today's fire service as we're really looking at how the economy is affecting service delivery and how we're doing operations in the field. And I'm very excited to have on a guest with me from North Carolina. It's Derek Clouston. Derek is a services supervisor with the Office of State Fire Marshal, who does and oversees the training throughout the state of North Carolina. And Derek comes in with a ton of experience, starting in a volunteer department, progressing into a large municipal department in Fayetteville, North Carolina, where there's a large military establishment. And he's got a strong history in hazardous materials, for one. But he's really done a lot of work in the past probably 3 or 4 years, concentrating in the last year or so, with work with officers and take an approach that I think is going to be really interesting. And I'm not going to steal the thunder right off the bat, but he's going to bring in something today that I think is really going to open the eyes to some people and maybe change what we need to be thinking about when we're in the field. And we've talked about this a lot in Training and Tactics. We're just excited to have a show like this on, and we hope our listeners find, you know, just the value that I feel we're going to get from it. Again, for our listeners, you know, Training and Tactics Talk is focused directly to, you know, getting information for firefighters and officers on the streets so that their training and their tactics are just the best that they can be. And we invite our listeners that, you know, are on with the show, if they got a question, to email us at radio@firehouse.com, and we can get those questions answered for you. Derek, welcome on board. You know, it's great to have you. It's great to have you as a colleague in the state, and I'm just, you know, excited about what we're going to talk about today.
Well, Doug, we appreciate the invite, and I look forward to it also. And, you know, I think we all share the same common goal in the fact that we just want to make it better for everybody, and we're all in it for the same purpose. And, like I said, I appreciate it and look forward to the broadcast.
Well, it's really timely that we're talking about some of this stuff. What we're going to do for our listeners today is Derek brings a concept in that's been published out there, but he's really put a unique twist to it, and it's the Powell Doctrine. And right now we're still during war times, and we've got to take a little bit of focus and truly look at what we're doing in the fire service with resources, with the information we have, with the training that we can, you know, give our people and their talents. And that's a lot of what the military does when they begin preparing for what we call missions. And we even equate most of our responses, especially the bigger ones, as in deployments or whatever, as missions. But we don't think about every time that bell goes off as this being an engagement of a mission, and we should have some pretty strong focuses. So, Derek, I want to throw it over to you. I've listened to this program that you've put on before. I want you to just give us a brief introduction, how we got to the thought process of comparing the Powell Doctrine and the fire service, and how we really need to be examining ourselves to what the military does.
Well, Doug, it all started, we, just like everybody else, you know, subscribed to the Firehouse magazine, and Eric Lamar wrote a real compelling piece back in August of 2007, I believe it was. And in reading that, it was one of those things that we read and, you know, kind of put it in the toolbox. And approximately a year and a half ago, in the wake of course, Charleston and our own tragedy here in North Carolina with and responding with the Salisbury Fire Department, the tragic loss of firefighter Iverson and firefighter Monroe, we set out to develop a contemporary, updated strategy and tactics program that kind of synthesized building construction, fire combustion dynamics, ventilation, all these things together, and really done a lot of research out there. And, you know, like I said, we had it in the toolbox, and we pulled the Powell Doctrine out. And when you look at the lessons that we're learning from all these different large lost fires and firefighter fatalities that we're seeing out there, the four basic concepts of the Powell Doctrine are very applicable to that. And so as we started drilling down and trying to get things to where we could get them presented to people in a clear and concise manner, one thing that became very evident to everybody on staff and the development people from all over the state that were helping with the program, that was assistant state fire marshal's office with it, was that, you know, this was going to be a very key thing to get into the people's heads that were sitting in the program. And so what we done is we took Eric Lamar's article and the four parts, and we really we broke down each of the four tenets of the Powell Doctrine even further to really make sure that people, whenever they went back to their jurisdiction, that they could go and review not only, you know, how it's not all about what you do on the scene, but it's about how you, like you said, Doug, how you train, how you do risk analysis and assessments in your district, how you establish your first alarm assignments. You know, a lot of times when we establish our first alarm assignments, you know, how much thought are we putting into it? And then we took it even further, because so many times when we talk strategy and tactics, we tend to put things in nice little boxes. Okay, you got three engines, a ladder, and a truck company or a rescue. And so many times that isn't the case out in suburban or rural America. So, you know, we had to develop a kind of a well-rounded approach because our audience was so varied across the state. So that's kind of what led up to the use of it and you know, in basically going in and taking those four points and even expanding them even further.
Well, I know that in this doctrine, it talks about engagement. And one of the pieces that sticks out to my mind is in the Gulf War, where Colin Powell was so, you know, prominent, that when they were going to engage somebody or a military person into combat, there was a very strong strategy for entrance, performance, and exit. Now, when you think about that, and this is something that's key as we begin talking about our missions in the fire service, how much emphasis, and you hit on this, on like our first alarm assignments and the risk assessment, how much thought process do we really put into what are our rules of engagement? You know, what are those rules of engagement? You know, what is our mission? What's it going to take to get our people in? What is their mission, and will they know that when they accomplish it? And what do we got to do to get them back out and say mission accomplished? And I think a lot of what we do sometimes in the fire service, and especially when we start getting short-staffed, is try to do so much more with less. And, you know, in conversations over the past couple of weeks I've had with, you know, fire chiefs from across the United States, is that they're having to really take a close look at this, and I think about, you know, one specific chief in the Northeast that was telling me, I'm down 20% of my department. And you think 20% of your department being down because they're not being able to fill it, you know, they're losing these positions to attrition, but 20% changes the dynamics of the rules of engagement.
Absolutely does. And, you know, one thing that we, a lot of the feedback we got is, well, you know, if you compare this to the Gulf War or even the or Gulf War II, you know, Desert Storm II, however you want to look at it, was this, you know, we had time to build up. We had time to do all these things. You know, when the bell hits, we don't have time to do that. Well, what we try to get across to people, you know, if that fire chief in the northeastern part of the country is down 20%, you know, he knows that he's down 20%. So we do have the time that whenever we go out and we start looking at the issues that we're facing today, it's not about, you know, if you start planning when the bell hits and you arrive on scene, it's too late. You know, when you look at the emphasis that is placed on risk assessment, risk analysis by the Center of Public Safety Excellence through the accreditation process, insurance services offices, through the things that they talk about on what their requirements for pre-fire planning and training is, you know, that is all to me. That is everything that the military does before they decide to go in. It's already done. They've got it pre-planned. They know what their plans are. So the fire service can do it. And in this point in time in the history of the fire service, it's like you said, Doug, no other time in probably the history of the fire service has it become such an important aspect of the job of our leaders and our company officers, especially to sit down and review, if you're down 20%, what have you done to your first alarm assignments? And so many of the first alarm assignments that you see in departments across the country, and we see them here in the state as well, you know, you see it. Typically, we go off the assumption that we're going to stop it with the first line, and that's the extent that we plan our responses on. What we've got to start doing is we need to start planning our responses for not stopping it with the first line. And if you're down 20% in your staffing, 30%, whatever it is, or if you're a volunteer department, and you know you've got people now having to work 2 and 3 jobs because they've been laid off, you know, you've got to beef up and you've got to put the resources on the ground, just like you heard the military say, we're going to put boots on the ground. That's what we've got to do. We've got to start putting boots on the ground. And we need to stop thinking that we have to do it all ourselves. You know, the fire service has a rich tradition dating way back to you know, when the insurance companies and the companies would race to the scene, and the first one to throw the ladder, put a hose on the ground, that was the insurance company that got the fire. And all that is there, that history and that tradition is there. You know, we can continue that in a respect that we need to start calling outside people to help us if our city, our town, or our volunteer departments can't get the resources we need, then we need to be reaching out, developing partnerships, developing policies and procedures to get the resources we need, because I don't care where you're at, it's a resource game, and we've got to have the resources, and it's got to be overwhelming.
And part of this is a mentality, if you will, that thought process. And you've heard me say this, I've said it several times, you know, on the podcast, is we've got people that are in the field, and their whole mentality is we've got to be aggressive. You know, we're down people, whatever we do, if we're going to save this, if we're going to, you know, stop this fire progression in this building or in this room or make this rescue, whatever it may be, the mentalities are out there that we've got to be aggressive. And I think there's a fine line there. And I stand up and I said this, you know, so many times in programs that I've done, and again, I've said it on, you know, training and tactics multiple times, that fine line between aggressive and reckless is there. And I think what we're finding in today's mentality of a lot of our firefighters, or what's being etched to them by officers even, is that we've got to be super aggressive. And that transfers over to that reckless stage. And we've got to take a different approach. And we talked about this. Yeah, we've talked about this several times. And, you know, with it, it's not necessarily that you can't be aggressive. Maybe that aggressive is not interior attacks. It's an aggressive offensive posture on a defensive, you know, landscape. So, again, this comes back to some of the stuff you're talking about that's very important. Well, let's really dive into that. You got anything else you really want to bring out on that first point that's in that Powell Doctrine?
Well, you know, I think when you look at aggression, I don't think anybody's saying there's anything wrong with aggression. As long as you've done good risk assessment, you know what you got, but most importantly, it's not only about the risk assessment. A risk assessment is more than just doing a 360. You know, a lot of people say, I've done a 360. Okay, well, that's great. You know, that's one part of it. You can do a 360 all day long, but if your first alarm assignment contains 10 people, you can walk around the building all day long. If you're on a commercial structure and your risk analysis, if you've done one, and you look at your critical skills and tasks that you've got to complete on that fire ground, 10 people isn't enough to start operating in interior mode. It's just not enough. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, we might not have time to wait for those additional units. We might not have time to do all those things. You know, a lot of times, you know, sometimes you got to slow down and make time to get the job done. And all we're saying, you know, when we say committing troops, if you look at that first tenet of the Powell Doctrine, committing troops must be an absolute necessity. You know, what we're saying there is if you're going to commit somebody, have the resources there to back them up. Do not just blindly say, we're going to go inside of every fire. And there are departments out there today, like Doug, like you said, you got rich traditions, rich histories. They're very aggressive. You know, and that aggression is fine as long as, like what you said, it's not reckless aggression. if your first alarm assignments are to the point that you've got the staffing you need, the equipment you need, the policy procedures and the training, all the stuff that you got to pull together to make a good interior aggressive attack like what we do in the fire service. As long as you've got that, you're fine. Where we're running into problems is we are fighting fires in the new culture of the fire service, where before the tactics that were developed in the 50s, 60s, and 70s where we had 4- and 5-person companies, now we're running 2- and 3-person companies, and we're still trying to apply the same tactics, and it doesn't work. And for some reason, you know, a majority of the fire service has not really grasped on to the fact that, hey, you know, we've got to change the way we operate. We've got to change the way we do business if we don't have these people. And, you know, one thing that I would say is you know, I was speaking to a fire chief right here in North Carolina, and he almost lost some guys in a house fire. And he went to his manager and he said, here's the deal, Mr. Manager. You know, we're not doing it anymore. You know, this is what I got to have to affect the interior attack. We are not going interior anymore until we get these resources on the scene. And the manager did not ridicule him. He said, hey, okay, that's what we got to do to be safe. That's what we got to do to be safe. But so many times the fire service takes a stance, well, we're just going to keep asking for people, keep asking for people. And in today's government and our physical limitations that we have, the staffing is just not there. So we've got to figure out other ways to make up for it.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And that, you know, that's definitely, you know, trickling over to the volunteer side as well, as we see the numbers of people, you know, able to respond and, you know, the ability to keep people, you know, in volunteer departments because of just, you know, what they have to do to survive in today's society is definitely has changed. So let's move to the second piece of that Powell Doctrine. Let's get that introduced here.
Okay. Basically, the second piece of the Powell Doctrine says there must be a compelling risk posed, and here's the key word, by not acting. In other words, it's kind of like the hazmat side. You know, I can't help it. It comes out in me every once in a while. But, you know, hazmat, you know, we always ask ourselves the question before we make an entry, what's the worst thing that can happen if we don't make this entry? What's the absolute worst thing? You know, it's, you know, hazmat is, and I'm not saying that, you know, you can do structural firefighting this way. Obviously, you can't. But, you know, in hazmat, we look at things, we're very deliberate, and we do a lot of research things before we start going into these incidents. And basically what the Powell Doctrine is saying is there must be a compelling risk posed by not acting. And you can get into a lot of different arguments in this. I think the key to it is that a department has to train its officers and its members and have a culture within the department that states we are not going to put people in harm's way for things that it just doesn't matter. Now, I don't know what those are. I'm not going to sit here and say that, you know, it's a nice, you know, there's a cookie-cutter solution for every community out there. Because let's face it, every community is not the same. But each department in the country needs to sit down and take an honest look at themselves and say, what are we going to be able to do, what can we do, and what can't we do? And what's the worst thing that's going to happen? In other words, what are we willing to risk? What are we going to go into? It's the old risk versus benefit thing that we've all heard. But what are we willing to risk? And if we risk it, you know, what is the outcome going to be? And what is the line that we're going to say no?
And I think you're going down a road, and I'm going to throw this term out again. It's called true situational awareness. And when you talk about the hazmat philosophy of what is the worst case if we don't go in, and truly doing the analytical approach, I think part of what we've missed in the fire service for so many years is that true understanding of building construction and fire behavior. And, you know, lo and behold, we're looking at a document, and this is part of y'all's class, is in I think it's 1947, the report on building construction to the president, the
yes,
concerns
sir.
That were there.
Yes, sir.
Can you imagine, you know, being on a busy interstate and being a dog that's hit and spinning? These people that wrote that document, can you imagine with the building construction features they had then versus what we have now? So if it was such a concern then, look at what we've changed. And when I look at firefighters and the amount of time that's going in and the rejuvenation of, you know, fire behavior is a true dynamic of understanding fire attack that's being pushed out there. I know Dave Dotson's done a lot of work with this with the Art of Reading Smoke. I know that several states have started beefing up their programs. You know, North Carolina, you know, I'm very proud, you know, to be from North Carolina in the fire service and say that, you know, the new program that's out with Firefighter 1 and 2 has an extremely beefed up fire behavior and building construction component. Because I think those two key components marry together. They haven't changed. We always need to know how the building is going to react under fire. It's under demolition. And that fire is only going to behave in that building as that construction features allow it to behave. So part of that situation is understanding your crew, the amount of people you may have, the dynamics that you have, the training, you know, what you have in the reserve, all the tactical components that have to go in place to be able to do this. And you've made mention to something that has become near and dear to my heart as I work on accreditation as well, is in that standard of cover, there's critical tasks that have to be, you know, looked at for a scene. But it's very specific to what you're saying. The rules of engagement, you know, what do we have to do? And it's a risk assessment. And I truly don't believe that a lot of fire departments across our great nation have done really true risk assessments and know what they're getting into. Because if you go look at the NIOSH reports, one of the key things is size up. Well, if you do the 10 rules of engagement, which is truly size up and situational awareness, we're back to exactly what you're talking about here. And I want you to go on a little further with this because I know you got a lot of thoughts on this.
Yeah, you know, regardless of whether the department is seeking accreditation or not, you know, one thing that I think is critical is you've got to know what your lag or delay is in setting up operations. You know, and the problem that we have in the fire service is we try to take that same approach, Doug, to firefighting. We call it the old 90% rule. 90% of the fires that we go to are single-family dwellings, 1 to 2 rooms involved. We get up, get off the truck, get there, stretch a line, you know, cut a lap around the building, and, you know, we're in and out of the building. I mean, my little volunteer fire department right here where I'm at had a house fire early this morning. You know, we were from the time we went out to the time we backed in was 2.5 hours this morning. And, you know, 2 lines on the ground, you know, our automatic aid, you know, came in, assisted us, and we were there and gone. It was a bread and butter fire. But the problem with that bread and butter that we see, and this is one thing that we see a lot in our class that we do, in this program that we do where we utilize the POW doctrine, is they do a very good job. The students do a very good job. The officers that come in and do a really good job on that bread and butter. But one thing that we throw at them a lot of times is something that, you know, something that you see that is always there. You have that, you know, Murphy is an optimist, and we throw that at them. And so many times, what they start realizing is if everything doesn't go just right, their first alarm assignment is severely lacking in the resources they need to get the job done. So what your risk analysis does is it helps you to prepare for that. Your risk analysis, through that process, whenever you go out and you're in your district and you're pre-planning your district and you're doing the things that you should be doing and you're looking at your buildings and you're looking at access and all these things that are out there, water supply, on and on and on, what should start happening is that an acute awareness is developed about those challenges and those places that you're going to have and the issues you're going to have when you go into these areas. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, what we see with the urban sprawl and the growth within the suburban and rural areas that we're seeing is, you know, people are building 5, 8, 10,000 square foot houses out in the country. Well, you know, that's not a house. That's a commercial structure with four or five people living in it. That's what it is. And if departments try to put that same mold that they put on a standard 2,500 square foot house, they're losing before the tones ever go off or the bell hits. So what we've got to learn to do, and what I think we've got to do a better job of, is within our system that we're operating in, within that box that we're operating in that we call, you know, whatever fire department you're on, we've got to look at it and say what, and be honest with ourselves, what can we effectively respond to with the resources that we put on an incident? What are we effectively going to be able to do safely? And if you're to a point where something is outside of that realm, then you've got to take positive actions to correct that instance to where you are putting those additional resources on scene. And only through a good risk analysis program are you ever going to do that. And a lot of that goes back to, you know, we have fallen into the trap of, well, ISO requires only this, or, hey, this is all we're going to do because of whatever the, you know, that's what we've always done. You know, I think every fire department out there today in today's economy that has had layoffs, has experienced layoffs, and volunteer departments might not have had layoffs, but I guarantee you, I know my volunteer department, you know, we're struggling, you know, for members. But we're very fortunate to have the ones we do have. But we've all got to sit and take a very close look at what's going on and say we've got to change the way we do business. And either adding additional resources to our first alarm assignments or figuring out other ways to get the resources that we need on the scene.
Absolutely. Well, Derek, we're reaching the halfway point of the show, and I'm just super excited, and I hope our listeners are really taking all this in, because this is the type of stuff that even our firefighters down on the streets really need to be thinking about. This is not high officer, you know, chiefing type stuff in a sense. These are the same thought processes I think our firefighters need to be in. So as we approach this halfway point in the show, we do want to invite our listeners, you know, to send us your questions to radio@firehouse.com. You're listening to Training and Tactics Talk. We'll be back right after this.
Radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to Training and Tactics Talk. I'm your host, Douglas Klein. On the show with me is from the Office of State Fire Marshal in North Carolina, one of their supervisors in one of their divisions, which is Derek Clouston. He's over the training division, supervising, you know, what's going on in the field. And we're talking about the Powell Doctrine and how this really, truly relates to the fire service. And, you know, we're going to pick up where we left off in the first half, and we're going to talk about overwhelming resources and then exit strategies in this half of the show. But when we think about overwhelming resources, looking out there, most of the time, departments, and this is a true statistic, we're probably responding to fires, working structure fires, with on the average 10 or maybe less people. Now, let's think about it. There's a standard out there for both the career and the volunteer, which is 1710 and 1720, that has some time stamps on it when we need to get our people on the scene and companies on the scene. We've also got to look at this is a sandbox that we're playing in, and we can't be selfish. If we're going to be safe, we can't be selfish. We got to invite people into play, and that's exactly what we got to do. And some of this is beginning to occur. There's still some of that mentality out there, Derek. I know you know about it, that, oh, this is my district, you can't come in and play. But a lot of that's changed, and, you know, fortunately I live in an area where that's changed. The last place that I lived, which was over in Person County, when I was working in Chapel Hill as a battalion chief, I was on a volunteer department, Timberlake Fire Department, and in Person County it was an automatic on any structure fire, three-station dispatch, because of the need for what? Resources, personnel, equipment. In a rural setting, it's water supply. Rockingham County, that I'm living in now, follows the same suit. You know, being in the Ruffin District, working, you know, very, very closely with the fire chief out there as like an administrative chief, you know, working on this risk assessment component for them, trying to, you know, make some changes within the organization. We've looked at this, and fortunately, the three-station response exists. One of our biggest risks that we've identified is we don't have a lot of water supply at all. And to get water supply, the distance of travel is, you know, pretty substantial. So in our responses, a lot of the areas we've asked one of the departments who has a wealth of tankers to send two tankers into a particular area. So we're looking at this. This is part of what we're seeing and what we're going to have to do. So let's relate this. I know you've done a lot of research to this as it relates. This is a big component of the program that y'all do, is understanding your resources. So, Derek, let's hear from you.
Yeah, I had a good friend, Kevin Gordon. He's a training chief in Charlotte Fire Department. And he helps us teach in this program and done a lot of stuff with him and just kicking stuff around. And, you know, one of them good, you know, he has them good talks there after class or over dinner. And one of the best things I've, you know, that I can relate it to is something he said is you never get even. You never want to get even. And if you pull up on the scene of a fire, whether you're a urban fire department, you know, and you know what your resources are, you got two or three engines, you got a ladder, a rescue, and a chief coming, or you're that small rural fire department that, you know, it's going to take you three or four or five departments to get, you know, 15, 20 people there in the middle of the day. You know, one thing as an incident commander on a dynamic incident like we respond to on a daily basis in this country, one thing that we've got to do is ensure that whenever we're sitting there and we start assigning tasks out to our engine companies and we're assigning tasks and we know we've got fire attack going on, we've got search going on, we've got ventilation going on, we've got all these things going on. If you ever start looking around and you notice you're the only guy standing out in the front yard and you're in command and you look around, there's nobody else, you don't have anything in staging, you don't have anything, a ready resource, and a lot of times people say, well, I've got a rapid intervention team, a fast team, whatever you want to call them. That's my backup. That's my ace in the hole. Well, the problem is that's not your ace in the hole, because if all your resources are committed to the interior of that structure and they're fighting fire and they're engaged, chances are, and the studies show, that the first RIT team will do one thing typically and one thing only typically, and that is they will locate the downed firefighters, and they might get one out. You look at the Phoenix study in relation to Tarver and some of the other things that we've seen. You know, rapid intervention is not rapid. You know, we've all heard it. We've seen the stuff online. We've read it in the articles in the magazines. You know, we're teaching it. You know, so if that one team, if that's all they're going to do, and then you call for your second alarm, well, it's too late. You're already behind the eight ball. So one thing that we really emphasize to our people is do not get even. And if you're sitting there and you make your assignments and you realize that you're even, you know, you need to start making some type of provision to get additional help on the way right then. Don't play the game that so many departments play and say, and it goes back to what we said a little while ago, you know, when we talk about committing troops, you know, don't play the game and set your alarms based on the fact that I'm going to stop it with the first line. You need to be thinking, I'm not going to stop it with this first line, so go ahead and get you some additional resources. And I know a lot of departments have went to what they call automatic add. You know, first do engine pulls in or first do unit pulls in, they advise a working fire, they automatically dispatch an automatic add engine, automatically, incident commander, nobody has to call for it, it's automatic. That helps to alleviate, you know, some of that, you know, making sure that you're not even. And one thing that I think, the other trap that we get into a lot of times when we talk about overwhelming resources must be applied, is especially in the rural setting and suburban settings, you know, so much of the strategy and tactics programs that are out there today focus on, in the articles that we see in the different publications fire service-wide, focus so much on urban settings and things of that nature that a lot of times, you know, when you start talking about rural water haul and you start talking about rural fire operations, there's not a whole lot of techs out there. And it's an area that's wide open to get into for people to go out and look at, but it's very important for your volunteers especially to be able to go out and understand this overwhelming resources, because it's going to take them 2 to 3 times more in requests as far as departments. And then what you're looking at in most rural areas is your travel times are so much further in your rural areas, because they are rural, and typically they don't follow the same deployment standards or the same deployment methodology that you would see either through like your standards of response cover or if you look at the ISO 1.5, 2.5. So you know, those are the things that you really got to drill down into when you start talking about your risk assessments and you start tying all this stuff together. Number 3, overwhelming resources must be applied. You know, everything's building up to that. And once you make that decision to commit your people and to get them in that building, you better make sure that you're not the only one standing outside whenever you've got all your assignments made. You either need to have resources on the way and have it ready. One other thing that I heard a seasoned battalion commander tell me one time was he always told his captains and he always told his other people, he said, "You always keep me a 1-in-1 outside with me." In other words, he wanted a minimum. If he had everything working, he wanted a 1-in-1, a 1 engine and a 1 truck right out there with him, because he wanted to make sure that he was not even. And that's the biggest thing, because if you're even, you're behind. And the problem is the way that we're going in today, less staffing, the way the building construction is, all this other stuff is working against us. So we're already behind. So the need to apply those overwhelming resources is just at a premium. We've got to be able to do it.
I can definitely relate, growing up in a very rural setting of West Virginia and actually riding 55 minutes one way to a structure fire. Well, needless to say, when we got there, there were ashes in the basement, and I truly have never lost a foundation. Just to throw a little humor here, I did burn up the middle of an intersection one time on a gas leak, but, needless to say here, there is that need, and we've got to identify that early. And, you know, one of the things that I'm seeing departments doing, they have truly looked at some risk assessments, is they're doing those automatic ads, or their first alarm assignment is beefed up with, you know, mutual aid companies surrounding them coming in, automatically leaving, you know, if it's on one side of the, say, the district of, and I'll use, say, a city of 15 square miles and say, 16,000 people. Use an automatic aid to where they're sending somebody or additional companies in automatically on that first alarm to have extra people so that you have that 1-in-1. And that's beginning to go on. And, of course, you know, you hear people, you know, criticize, well, that's, you know, why are you calling that? You're wasting the resources. You know, you're stealing from, you know, the other district. What if they have a call? Well, you know, when I'm on that response, I'm not worried about what if on another call. I'm worried about what if on my call, because it is definitely paramount that we could see a what if. I mean, we're looking at that. That is highly probable we could have a what if. The what if of the second call, well, you know, you kind of got to play those odds a little bit, but, you know, the real hazard or the real risk, you know, the volatility is already occurring, and we need to look at that. And, of course, you hit time of the essence and being even. So we got these people. We're trying to work towards this. We're trying to get this strong thought process of being very analytical, being very thought-provoking in what are we doing to assess a risk, what are we doing to identify the issues, how many people do we need. So we get them there, but this exit strategy, you know, we always got to have a strong exit strategy of what are we going to do to get out. What's our mission, you know, once we're in there? How long does it take us to get out? Or what if something goes wrong? Can we get out? So let's dive into that, Derek.
Well, I think, you know, and especially looking at, you know, at the current NFPA documents and what we're seeing on air management, you know, we have seen so much done and so much positive work done in air management, Mayday, Rapid, I mean, all these things. I mean, you look at all the work that's been done and the effect and the positive effects that's had on the fire service, you know. But a clear exit strategy isn't – it's more than air management. It's more than, you know, okay, yeah, we know how to – you know, we have a Mayday policy. We have rapid intervention policies. You know, we train on that. It's more than that. And it goes back to the fact to the basis of, you know, when you're outside and you're that person calling the shots, you know, your no means no and your yes means yes. And everybody in every department who does aggressive interior firefighting, and they do that, that is their mode that they operate in, and they've done their risk assessments, they've done a risk analysis, they've got the resources coming, all these things that we've talked about so far. The final piece of it is to train your people on what and the exit strategy is for your department. What are the things that you expect your incident commanders to be able to do, your company officers, and even your firefighters to say and recognize situations when it's, you know, when it's time, you know, to get out. You look at the Forestry Service, you know, the stuff that they look at on the, you know, the situations at Shout Lookout, and how much they train on that. You know, all those things that they do. We could take those same basic tenets that they say, you know, those lookout situations, those things right there, and we could apply them very easily to structural firefighting, to where a department can go out and look at their training and look at the things that they want to do and apply through training, policy development, and education to their members and say, at these points, this is what tells us to get out of a building, period. There's no – and firefighters, I'm one of them. I'm one of the worst ones to say, Chief, just give me two more minutes, or Command, give me two more minutes, I'll have it. Well, the problem with that is they're inside, task saturated. You're outside, and if your incident management system is working correctly, okay, and you're able to truly get that step back, and you're seeing the whole picture like you're supposed to be, your division officers, your group officers, everybody's reporting back to you, you've got more of the picture. You've got more of what you were saying earlier, Doug, that situational awareness that you got to have. And that's what's really important, is that situational awareness. And that incident commander, if he's doing everything he's supposed to be, and I know it's not a perfect world, but if he has a high SA, a high situational awareness, what's going on, they need to know what the exit strategy is. You know, you look at fighter pilots. You look at the fighter pilots. You know, they are trained very heavily on when to eject. You know, and they got it. They got a system in place, and they know these are the parameters, and this is when we're going to punch out. We need the same thing in our fire departments. Every fire department should know what their eject policy is. You should know what it is. Hands down, your people should know. It should be there, and it should be trained on, and it should be, you know, it should be a culture in the department. It's not a thing where you're hanging your head down and say, yeah, we lost this one, or hey, you know, whatever. Look, you know, if they didn't want the thing to burn, they'd have put sprinklers in it. That's just all there is to it. They, you know, you're fighting a losing battle. And the other thing on a clear exit strategy is, and this is key, and it kind of goes back to the building construction, is we've got to change, or we've got to start looking at and getting into looking at our building construction. You know, we like to go in, and we're still putting buildings in these nice little neat categories, you know, type 1, type 2, type 3, so on and so forth construction. Well, the problem is we don't have just type 1 construction anymore. We've got buildings that look like type 1 construction, but by golly, when they get done with it, it's got a little bit of everything in it. So, you know, our exit strategies have to look at our building construction. Because if you pull up on the scene and your size up, your initial size up, you come up and you say, you know, I've got a type 1 bit, or however you do your size up, and you're putting it in one of those nice little boxes, well, guess what? with the way they're building buildings today, you can have three different types of construction and you not know it unless you went and done a good risk analysis, done a good pre-planning, you've seen the building going up. We've got several buildings right here in my hometown here in Ashboro had bowstring trusses on them. And I know, too, for a fact that they come in, put a nice stucco surround on it, went in, put a nice A-frame roof over it. You don't even know it's a bowstring truss roof anymore. The only way you know it is because pre-planning and risk assessments. And that's very key, and that's all part of your exit strategy as well. So I guess, you know, being here at the end, Doug, all four of these components build upon themselves, and that is the crux of what I see that we, as the fire service as a whole, and the economy and the posture of operation that we see today, that's what we've got to start doing. We've got to look at this, and we've got to be serious about it.
Well, I couldn't agree more with you, Derek. You know, the fire service is a very dynamic group of people, and it's a dynamic organization, and we're constantly changing. And if we don't adapt to what we're being faced with in every aspect, the three-dimensional component, that 360-degree, you know, compass look at everything that's going on around us, from staffing to, you know, rules of engagement to risk assessment to, you know, how we actually have standards of covers and response policies, I think we're missing the boat. And the big thing that I think is really, and I'm just tickled to death, you know, to have something like this on the show, is that our firefighters need to be thinking a lot deeper than what they do. It's not, you know, see water or see fire, spray water. You know, I do what my officer tells me to do. There is a degree that the officer is in control, and we have to be in a paramilitary organization. But I also think that each individual adds to that team. When they have a true understanding of what's going on, they may pick up on something, they may have a vantage point or a viewpoint, they may be able to see things that, you know, is precluded to another individual of that team or the officer of that team. And understanding all of these rules and truly having fire service knowledge in that building construction and fire behavior and operations, I feel so strongly about that. I mean, I spend just a ton of time. Every live fire training that I do, we relate building construction features and fire behavior. We run a full fire behavior lecture sitting inside, starting with, you know, fire starts with a little bitty flame about a half inch tall, and this is why. You know, you have heat, fuel, oxygen, chemical chain reaction, and this is what happens when it begins to grow. And we look at the fire dynamics. We look at heat fluxes. We look at what happens when you open a window or you close a window, when you put somebody standing in the hallway blocking, you know, the natural components of airflow. These are things that we've got to really get down. It almost becomes it's a study now, because our battleground, if we'll call it, has really changed. And the buildings are our enemy. I mean, that's what we're engaging in fire suppression tactics. The building is our enemy. And I think it's just critical that before we engage in battle, we know everything there is to know about our enemy. Derek, it's great to have you on the show. I think we've really, you know, put some things out for our listeners, you know, tuning in to training and tactics that they can use in their departments, whether it be for a training session, whether it be with their companies, whether individuals are coming on and listening. I think that we've provided them with a wealth of knowledge today, and I really appreciate you coming on. I appreciate the Tim Bradley and the Office of State Fire Marshal for allowing you to participate and to share this program that's out there and that they're endorsing and allowing you to do. They're doing a great job with this, and it just, you know, I'm really excited that we've got some of this stuff out. It's, you know, it's good material. It's the things that we need to be focusing on. For our listeners, again, if you've got anything that you want to bring up, comments or questions, send us an email at radio@firehouse.com. Derek, any closing comments?
Well, Doug, just once again, I'd just like to say thank you, and we're glad that we could help you out with this. And, you know, we've talked about it several different times, and we appreciate it. We're glad we're here, and you know, we would love to hear any comments out there, any thoughts anybody else has. You know, our programs are constantly under revision and review, and you know, anything that you've got, any thoughts that you have that we could help make ourselves or make our programs better, we would love to hear from you. I'd just like to thank you, Doug, for the invite, and to Firehouse for hosting training like this and making it to where, you know, people can go out there and our firefighters can get this type of training and have this type of interaction with each other, and we really appreciate it, and thank you so much.
Well, you're quite welcome, and again, please, from the folks at firehouse.com and myself personally, thank Larry Hughes and Tim Bradley for allowing, you know, this to occur. And for our listeners, I hope that you've enjoyed today's show, and we look forward to having you back next month as we look at training firefighters and fire officers on the streets with the best training and tactics and information that we can provide you with. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Douglas Klein, on Training and Tactics Talk. And remember, all your informational needs and training and tactics can be, you know, looked at throughout all the places, but we appreciate you being with Firehouse.com. Again, any comments, send them to us at radio@firehouse.com, and we look forward to seeing you next month. Stay safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to Firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.